Hey there. My name is Clint, and today I'm super excited to be joined by my friend Dev, who's had very cool security roles at Dropbox, Figma, and more. So thanks for joining me, Dev.
Thank you for having me. Excited to be here and looking forward to a fun conversation.
For sure, same. And for the people who don't already know you, would you mind giving people a little background about who you are, sort of your background in security, and yeah, whatever you'd like to share.
Yeah, absolutely. So my name's Dev. I lead currently security at Figma. I've been at Figma around 3.5 years. For people who don't know, Figma is a UX design tool built in the browser for collaborative design. Before Figma, I was at Dropbox for nearly 6 years, which I joined after my PhD at UC Berkeley focused on security. And so, yeah, I've been in security almost, I guess now, gosh, 14 years, 15 years. And so it's been a fun ride, and I'm super excited. And I guess, yeah, the other thing I would say is, I think there are a lot of people who joined security because they were hackers as kids and breaking things as kids. And I just, I'm not from that. I've written a bunch of papers and hacks, but I really got into security just because I feel like it's the most fun and interesting place to build software. And that's been true and still remains true. Attackers are evolving and it continues to be fun. So, yeah.
Oh, neat. I didn't know that you got into it a little bit late. I actually did too. I think I didn't start really in security until somewhere midway through college, maybe. So I'm curious, yeah, what sort of was your initial spark?
I think I was always excited with everything technology. Everything's interesting. And when you start your PhD program, there's sort of this conversation on what do you want to work on? What is exciting? And for me, it was everything's exciting. Every aspect of computing, everything is fun and interesting. And I think security was really the only field where I could do anything and everything. As I say, I worked on papers related to static analysis. I worked on papers with measurement, usability, formal methods. My outside minor, as they call it in Berkeley, was in law and technology. And so, yeah, it's been fun. I just so many things to think about when it comes to security, and I find that really enjoyable.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah, so we've actually known each other and been friends for years, and I can't believe I never asked you about that before. So yeah, it was in grad school when you sort of honed in on security.
Yeah. I think, I got some internships also that were more like software engineering, building stuff related to security somehow, like digital signatures and stuff. But yeah, I was doing internships related to other Java, shops and like machine learning and search engines and stuff like that. But I think only in grad school did I really focus in on security, and I'm glad I did. It's been such a fun industry and experience.
Cool. Yeah, that's neat. And actually, before we had ever met, I had read. So when I was a grad student, I think I had read some of your papers. I think maybe symbolic execution of JavaScript or something was like one of the papers I had read. So yeah, it was kind of funny years later that our paths crossed.
I know, yeah. So small world. It's super exciting. But yeah, thanks for reading the paper. It was a fun paper to write. So yeah.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, so let's see. I guess maybe just like a high level thing to kick things off. We're going to get a lot into your thoughts on sort of modern security programs and AppSec sort of in particular. But one thing that I wanted to talk about first. So in security, there can be a lot of I don't know. Some people say like security nihilism, or people who are sort of cynical and jaded about maybe their inability to affect change in their org, or that there's always more vulnerabilities. But you've actually said when we were chatting recently that you're a security optimist and that you believe we've made a lot of progress as a industry. And I'm actually inclined to agree as well. So yeah, I was wondering if you could share more about that. What makes you a security optimist?
Yeah, I think, I don't know, one, maybe I'm just fundamentally an optimist, but I think in general, I look back on when I started in the industry, application security flaws were one of the major causes of breaches. SQL injection was the main cause. And I think right before that, worms used to be a thing, network worms like Slammer and all that stuff. And we don't talk about those as much anymore, right? Like XSS, SQL injection, worms, these are not things that have sort of continued to harm us, continued to be top of mind for security people. I think we have learned that there are some structural things that we can do, better frameworks, better design of frameworks, I think guardrails, and we'll talk about that more, I'm sure, that can really, you know, significantly improve security posture. And I think that's been great. I think that it's easy to forget that in the broader scheme of things, just technology and software has taken on more and more things. And so, of course, the set of things to worry about has gone up, but the kind of things we worry about, I think, has changed. And that's a positive step, right? Like, we are making progress. I think today, when I look around, like, between, you know, stuff like WebAuthn, we know, for example, on how to really lock down on credential stuffing and password reuse attacks. And that's great, right? Like, that would have been 10 years ago, I think, when the FIDO Alliance started talking about this, it looked like such a long shot to make. And it's crazy, right? Like 10 years in the big scheme of things is not that long. and it's now everywhere. Everyone's talking about it. So yeah, I'm pretty optimistic. I think we'll make progress. I'm sure we'll find new problems, but that's fine. We'll keep making progress against those.
Yeah, I think a couple things that stood out to me about what you said. Like, one is in the grand scheme of things, like, tech as a field is very young, right? It's just like a few tens of years, and even security within that, I feel like modern, like, AppSec, if you will, was really probably not even early 2000s, but maybe like 2005, 2010 or something.
Yeah.
I don't know. You would know this specific date more, but like OWASP, like, wasn't around for a while. And then, obviously it's grown significantly since then. I guess from chatting with friends of mine who were security consultants back in like the days of yore, AKA like early 2000s, like at Sigil or ISEC Partners or places like that, I think it was very routine to just like come into even like a tier one really big company and just like wreck it immediately. Like, day one, you're just like XSS here, SQL injection on the login page, and just like everywhere. And these were like, you know, like multi-billion dollar companies. I think obviously those things still happen today, even on sort of like big companies, but certainly not to the extent it used to. Like, you have to be very persistent and very good, I think, to find one of those types of issues, whereas before it took like relatively low skill and it was everywhere. I think like the rollout of TLS also, like Firesheep and things like that. So there was, at one point, you know, most of the web was not TLS. And then eventually it was like, oh, we only need to do like the login page. And it was very difficult to convince, I think, like major players to like make everything HTTPS. And then that Firefox extension, Firesheep, which made it trivial to impersonate people's like, I think like Facebook, Twitter, and maybe other accounts that like gradually sort of forced major providers through shaming them. I totally agree that there's a lot more to do, but I think we've actually made pretty meaningful progress about the industry. I think Jim Manico has like a nice keynote about this as well, where he's just kind of like hyping up security.
Yeah.
Like you all, we like, you know, there's more to do, but like, look at all we've done. Like, we should feel good about that. And if I recall, I think he maybe calls out you by name somewhere in it. I feel like
Jim's,
I remember
Jim's
you sitting in the front row and being like, oh.
Yeah. Jim's great, though. Jim's always positive. So, I mean, I don't know whether it's because he lives in Hawaii or it's something else, but Jim's great. And also someone I look up to as someone who, you know, how to stay positive, how to stay excited. I mean, you said TLS. And I mean, yeah, I remember Firesheep. I remember Moxie talking about TLS. I remember all those, findings. And today in my browser, I have HTTPS everywhere mode enabled, and Chrome's talking about, you know, enabling it by default so that everyone's protected. And that's amazing, right? Like, that's what, 10, 12 years since we started talking about these issues. Again, like, at the scale of the internet, at the scale of like billions of users, that's pretty good. Like, that's a huge change. So I don't know. I'm pretty positive. I'm pretty excited. And even the SSL warnings, like, that allow us to bypass DLS errors, you know, click rates on that have gone way down because of immense investments in usability by browser vendors. So I think it's great. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. I think Adrian Porter Felt on the Google Chrome team had a really nice AppSec Cali talk about just like Chrome browser security and I think like usability of like SSL certificate warnings and a couple of other things that I don't know.
Yeah.
We can maybe link that in the show notes, but yeah, I thought that was nice.
Yeah. I think that was Adriana. I think she's changed. She goes with that now. And Adriana and I wrote the. We were co-authors on a paper on measuring how often people click on TLS warnings, and And yeah, I think the Chrome team really took that on under Adriana's leadership, I would say. And it's been amazing to watch, right? Like their follow-up papers and the AppSec Cali talk, we should definitely link to it. It's been amazing, and it really shows why we had to be thoughtful around not just like immediately switching things to first TLS, but like being thoughtful about let's not impact people and let's allow them to do their work while still making the change. And it's been great. Like kudos to the teams working on this. It's amazing.
Cool. Yeah, totally. Okay, so maybe just to give people some context about sort of the current security team size at Figma and like the different teams and things like that, we're gonna go into like some of the details, but maybe for people it's like useful framing to be like you know, like when you joined, how many people are on the team, what were different people working on, how many people are on the team now, and what are their focuses? Do you have like sub teams? Like a detection and response team versus like AppSec versus CloudSec or like generalists, specialists. Like we'll get into a lot of things in more detail, but I think about your like philosophy on things and how you approach things. But I think that like sort of the lay of the land is like useful context. So
Yeah, for sure.
over the 3.5 years, I think you said you've been at Figma.
I joined Figma to start the security team, and started with zero. And I think we are around 25 people now,
Oh, wow.
and we have with three teams and another data science team. So I'd say we have a CorpSec team that is focused on securing our laptops and computers that employees are using. We have a product security team that is looking at application security as we would classically think about it, as well as anti-abuse. And additionally, we have a infrastructure security team that is looking at stuff like CI/CD security, AWS security, data infra security, and so on. And yeah, it's I'm super lucky to work with some really amazing people, learn from them every day, and yeah, it's just a joy to be in Slack channels where you're learning every day. So it's awesome. Yeah.
Nice. Yeah, I've been impressed with the caliber of the people you've been able to convince to join your team, which I think is like a testament to I guess you as a leader, or maybe just you being convincing. I don't know. Maybe some combination of both.
Yeah. No, and also I think Figma as a company and the culture and the engineers that we get to work with, I think security engineers want to work with other great engineers and great coworkers. And I think kudos to Figma and Figma's leadership for a great culture that we have built. And so I'm excited to go to work every day, and that's great. Yeah.
Nice. Yeah, totally. Okay, so that's a little bit about Figma's team and how it's grown. I think one industry trend that you and I have talked about that I'd be curious to hear more on is you talked about sort of the spread of or maybe increase in security engineering, sort of emphasis on the engineering and maybe the role of like AppSec or ProdSec teams. So yeah, could you share a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I think the idea for this or the germ for this was Alex Stamos once gave a talk at AppSec California, I think 4 or 6 years ago, called AppSec is Eating the World. And I think his thesis was just that like more and more things are becoming AppSec-y, where we are approaching things from an AppSec lens. And that was really inspiring to me because I also started I was really focused on AppSec all till then in my career, and sort of that was inspiring to start thinking about, okay, where else can I use the skills I've learned in AppSec, and where else can I apply them to improve security of the organization, security of the product. And yeah, like that's where the germ started. And I think this, I would say, one lens to look at is that more and more things are code. There's this whole movement for infrastructure as code with things like Terraform and Pulumi. And I think when more things are code, more configurations is code, all the tools that we as AppSec engineers have applied also apply to those securing those systems, right? So earlier, setting up your infrastructure was setting up the rack and installing Linux and like all the ops, network ops, system ops, and things like that that you had to do. But for a modern cloud native organization today, it's a bunch of Terraform code, Pulumi code, and so things like secure libraries, secure frameworks, SemGrep for analysis, static analysis when you create a pull request, code review, negative tests, things like that that we have sort of, I think, historically applied in, let's say, web application development or application security, also apply to infrastructure, right? Like at Figma, we use Terraform for our AWS infrastructure, but also configurations for things like Snowflake, for GitHub, for Okta, and all of these. Like when people are making changes, we can run SemGrep analysis on it and say like, hey, this is a safe change or this requires extra review. Let's queue it up for security to take a look and things like that. And I think it's an exciting time. Like as more and more things, we can apply this tool that we have from AppSec that we have found to be pretty effective, right? Like as we started in the conversation, AppSec used to be the source of all breaches. And now it's we've made a lot of progress and there's a lot of lessons we could learn from it. So not only am I an optimist, I would say like I also want us to learn from things that worked and make progress on all the other risks. So yeah, it's an exciting time, I think.
Yeah, I like that insight a lot about things that used to either be done manually or sort of like one-off scripts. I think you said like network configuration, cloud architecture, cloud configuration. I think you even mentioned like Okta and Snowflake and other like configuration of business system software, maybe even like certain, authn or authc changes that are maybe not just within the application code itself, but more like CorpSec-y type things.
Yeah.
Like as more things from more domains go to code, then what are the things we learned about like securing and scaling sort of like high quality code, ideally securely, but even just like best practices. I think we also were talking previously about there's a bunch of like detection and response or those sort of like pipelines that allow you to write like custom logic that's maybe like Python in version control or things like that. And yeah, I think it's really neat to developers have been able to build like these massively large complex systems that are millions, billions of lines of code, and like they actually work somehow miraculously. So like I think learning from that for like how we can be better at like crafting scalable, resilient systems as security professionals in terms of like, cool, we have like our logic in version control, which means people can do peer reviews, people can look back at the history and like who changed what and for what reason. You look at Git logs or in like GitHub on PR comments or things like that. I like that.
I guess the example you brought up, CorpIAM, like I called it, like, you said CorpSec identity, and I think there's just so much there as an example, right? That's just like that one example is so exciting because today, a modern security team could look to like managing identity inside their organization in code. You can manage Okta and things like maybe access control tooling in code. Your AWS identity and permissions could also be in code in Terraform. So all of it is code. I think the other thing we can learn from application security is we have learned in product land when people are running authentication systems for the web that authentication is not a binary password and done. There's a lot of like machine learning detection signals that you can take. Was like, well, you just logged in from USA, you can't suddenly show up from Russia, right? Like that is suspect. Or you can look at how quickly a cookie is moving. Is it showing up with a new browser than it shouldn't? Can you do post auth detection of breaches? And all these things, these ideas still apply even for the corp identity space. So it's just a lot to learn. And I think that will make our internal identity systems just as robust as and all of that requires like investments in data and data infra. And again, there's a lot of code and systems to build there, but that will make our internal identity systems, as you said, more resilient, more adaptable, more flexible, and actually more usable, which is also amazing. So I don't think it's also like security versus usability or business productivity. It's actually your business organization can be more productive and you're more secure, which is just ideal, right? Like it's rare to find that. So it's super exciting.
Yeah, totally. I also remember just speaking of this sort of like security engineering, detection engineering, there was a nice panel this past Besides SF with, I think, led by maybe Jackie Bo and a couple of others about sort of like modern detection engineering, where they just emphasized over and over again the power or like leverage that you can get if people can like write their own detections, iterate on them, tune them. And I think you didn't maybe used to have to be able to read or write code in if you were a security professional, depending on like which like area of security you were in. And I guess to some extent that's still true, but I think that it really gives you a leg up. And I don't know, the more AppSec and ProdSec teams I'm talking with, and really just CloudSec or just any teams, I think you might not need to be like professional grade like developer, but definitely being able to read and write code, I think, is super valuable sort of regardless of which area of security you're in these days. So
Yeah. I think in general, I do want to be sort of one thing I'm sort of very, I try to be very clear about is, the, I don't want to say you need to know how to write code to sort of be a gatekeeping function, right? Like, I think security needs people from all sorts of backgrounds and all sorts of perspectives. And the more like we can broaden our community, that's amazing. And with things like ChatGPT and the amazing improvements in like LLMs and Copilot and stuff, like writing the code itself has become actually far easier. So I would, encourage more and more people to, join us. What's needed is, I think there's a term from, like, I think CS that's called like computational thinking, which is how would I ask a computer to do this, or how would I automate this? I do think that is needed. I do think, because like security threats are only increasing. There are fewer and fewer security people. We need to cover more and more things. And so the only way out is automation, reliable systems, scalable systems. And I think being able to think like, how would I ask a computer to do that? That computational thinking is needed. The code itself, as you said, it's a detail, right? Like, I think, and we're not writing like live, billions of users production system, especially. So it's fine. But I do want us to think about, how would I get a computer to do this? And I think that's an important skill. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good way to describe it. Yeah, I like that computational thinking where you can sort of decompose problems into their like core parts, figure out like okay, like which parts of these are maybe easier to automate than others, or like do we have existing things that can do that? And yeah, I totally agree. You don't necessarily need to know how to program to like get into security. Like definitely, I know super successful people with like all sorts of backgrounds. I was meaning it more in the like. Oh, if you were working in security or wanting to grow, like it's a useful skill, but not like a mandatory one, like before you start, but more just like
Sorry.
a useful skill in your tool belt. But yeah, I totally agree.
Absolutely. Just to be clear, I knew what you meant. I've learned over the time that unfortunately some people read it as a gatekeeper. I have to be very careful to sort of be like, no, what I mean by this is sort of not, oh, you need to have like 6 years of programming experience and like, build, solve dynamic programming problems in C++, right? Like, these are not the skills that we're looking for, right? So yeah.
Oh,
And
I do
like,
that every day at work. I don't.
yeah, exactly, right? Like, you're talking to two people who did PhDs at like, in CS like this. But yeah, that's not what's needed. But we do need sort of scalable systems and computational thinking, I think.
Yeah, I think since we're already talking about career stuff, okay, very brief diversion. I feel like it's useful to like choose like one little like foothold into security, like whether like basically like oh I want to do some like detection engineering or I want to do some AppSec or I want to do pen testing, and then like figure out the minimal set of things you need to know such that someone will pay you to do that full time, and just be like laser focused on doing that, and then like get to a place or like a job where you can do that full time, because you can only like if you're doing not security now and you want to do security, you only have so many hours in the day. Assuming you like ignore your friends and family and other responsibilities and like are only studying,
Please don't do that.
you just don't have that many hours. So I feel like with lots of career advice, they're like, oh, here's like all the things that you should know or could know. And I think there's like the more I learn about security, the more I realize there's like an infinite amount to learn and there's like so many subdisciplines that like it's impossible to know everything even within like one area. Like even knowing everything within like AppSec, I would be like is close to impossible. So I don't know. I feel like
I agree.
get to a place where you can do it full time and then just be like, oh, I'm gonna like increase my sort of set of knowledge over time. So like, hey, it's cool that you don't know how to program now. Like get to a place where you're like able to invest more time in learning security or other things and then just like gradually expand sort of like your surface area of knowledge over time.
I would say one, like, gradually expand. Also, this, I think I like saying this internally and reminding myself also, if there's one field that tells you again and again and again that you're wrong, it is security. I have built numerous systems that I thought was secure and someone broke them. And you can't like argue with that, right? Like, you can't, it's not like, breaking a wood piece or something. It's like, oh, well, you put too much pressure. It's broken, it's broken. Like, you can't like argue with like a bypass of your security controls, right? And so, and that's freeing. That's like, that all of us are learning, all of us are improving. And I think that's another thing, right? Like, even after you become, like, I'm learning every day, I'm trying to improve, I'm trying to increase my knowledge. And I think that's what makes our field fun, right? Like there is never a dull moment. I mean, Black Hat and Usenix just happened. I was reading some of the papers and research coming out, and you know, every year there's something that's like, oh my God, this is amazing, right? So I think we're always learning every year, learning. And so I think setting yourself up for learning and continuous improvement is sort of, personally, I think that's really far and away more important than where you start, right? Like, I think there's enough stories that you can talk about, but I think the example I give is like machine learning. You know, we've learned in machine learning that, you know, it doesn't matter where you start on your optimization. It's how quickly you descend down the like optimization curve, right? Like it's not like they start at a random point when they're trying to do machine learning. It's the how quickly you descend down the gradient that decides how quickly you converge. And so similarly, I think like, you know, just optimizing for learning and how quickly you learn is really the big one. And I think a lot of it is also the people around you, the community you are at, and your hunger and drive, but also opportunity. And so I think that's the other, like, I think, you know, making sure you are with a community of coworkers or people who you're learning from is sort of really key. I try to be the, you know, as much as possible, the dumbest person in the room so that I'm learning from others, right? Like that's kind of what I think about. Because we are learning all the time. And like, I know for sure security will teach me something new every quarter. So, yeah.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, I've also tried to optimize for growth in various like jobs I've selected and like the people I try to surround myself with. I think a lot of the people I know who I view as like very, very smart, they also similarly are like, how do I get to places where I'm the dumbest person in the room or the least informed on like whatever the topic is. So I don't know. I think that's solid advice I've seen repeated time and time again from people that I'm like, you know, a lot.
Yeah. I mean, and also, again, I guess we're both ex-grad school people. So, but I think the other thing I learned at Berkeley, one thing I learned at Berkeley was, you know, we're all learning. Like, I think that's what the PhD teaches you, because you're pushing new, you know, new edges of knowledge. The other thing that was interesting was like Turing Award winners, Fields Medal winners, usually the people who are at the top of the game are the ones who are sort of really humble and always curious and willing to learn. It's almost an anti-pattern if someone is proud and thinks like they know a lot. It almost like sort of tells me, because once you know a lot, you know that like there's so much more to learn is sort of my my theory. And so I find that like, yeah, everyone, all of us are trying to learn. And if like a Turing Award winner has the curiosity to learn and like engage, like at Berkeley, they would engage with like new undergrad students with that same level of curiosity. Like it's amazing. So I think that's also what I've learned. Like it just, it doesn't stop. Like you kind of have to continue learning forever, and it's great.
Yeah, I do think I've noticed sort of the Dunning-Kruger effect as well, where the people who are like very confident in their knowledge, like don't know enough to know how much they don't know. I don't know. I feel acutely aware as I learn more of like all the things I don't know. I feel like every year I'm like more aware of the things that I don't know. I know more things, but it's maybe like the rate of my. I've never thought of like graphing it this way, but it's like the amount of things you know increases, but like the amount of things you become aware of that you don't know, like maybe increases faster.
And then in security, you know, James Kettle gives a talk at Black Hat, and then they're like, oh, okay, I don't even. So, you know, it's like, I thought I knew HTTP, and then he comes with like, well, you, this desync thing is happening, and you're like, oh, no. So, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, man. Yeah, I love James Kettle's talks. You thought you knew how this basic principle of the internet worked, yeah, exactly. But you were incorrect.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's good. It's freeing just to keep learning. Yeah.
Yeah, agreed. So shifting paces a little bit. So one topic I want to dive into in a bit of detail is your thoughts on, so people call it different things, but like secure default, secure guardrail, sort of paved road as Netflix and others have called it. But this idea of like, how do we make the, before I sort of say how I would define it. Yeah, I'm curious. So I hear more and more organizations talking about this, but I'm curious to you, how would you define that like idea? And maybe if you think like one of those is more appropriate than others in terms of secure default, secure guardrails, paved road, like does one of those terms resonate more with you? Do you think they're different? I kind of use them a little bit interchangeably, to be honest, but But I think different people view them differently. So I'm curious what you think.
Yeah, I do think personally that there has been an evolution. Secure defaults was the term that we used to use. And I think we have moved to stuff like paved roads and guardrails. And I think that's great. But I think sort of because we use them often interchangeably, I personally found a meaning to that difference that I think is important. So I think when you look at road design or you read like road design literature, there's the paved road on which the car is supposed to go. Then there is the gravel or the shoulder, which is like if you make a mistake, one, there is a rumble strip that tells you, oh, you're doing something wrong. So you should probably, like, if the driver falls asleep, the rumble strip will wake them up. And then there's the shoulder in which they're still safe, but maybe not able to go fast. But they'll realize very quickly that something's wrong. And then there is the guardrail, which is just like, okay, if you really, mess up, at least you won't like fall off a cliff. The guardrail will stop you from making, I mean, your car will be damaged, you'll have a very bad day, your airbag is going to blow up, and things like that. But at least, like, extreme events are avoided. And I think that's something that I think to me resonates a lot more on what a fantastic, like, security defense looks like. That there is the paved road, there is a rumble strip, there's a shoulder, there's a guardrail. I think the danger with secure defaults is that just that one term is sort of saying there's only the paved road. And like the other stuff is important, right? Because I think if you don't have secondary defenses, like, people will run into scenarios. Like, sometimes you want to stop on the shoulder. Sometimes you want to go a little bit off-road, right? Like, there's another car, like, something happens and you want to try. Like, there's a reason why all these things exist. And I think, like, we should also support that. So I think, the example I often give is cross-site scripting protection. Just looking at secure frameworks would be secure default, but React needed dangerously set inner HTML as an escape hatch, and I think of that as like, okay, even if you're using dangerously set inner HTML, you still want something like DOM purify or two static HTML where you're able to at least say, okay, you're not using React's like templating system, but even if you're using dangerously set inner HTML, you shouldn't be allowed to just set XSS in. And then finally, there is still the guardrail of, well, if you really make a mistake and you forget that, we have a content security policy in place so that egregious risk is avoided, right? Like, that's how we approach XSS prevention at Figma, where we have like React secure frameworks, we have the checks on, SEMGREP is telling us that's the rumble strip that, like, whenever someone is using dangerously set inner HTML, that, hey, this is not supposed to be used. Like, are you sure? Here are other options you can use. And then there's also like DOM purify as a sanitizer. And then there is the content security policy, which is sort of the, overarching guardrail that prevents really egregious risk. And so I think I like that framing, like having four layers, and sometimes four is too much, but like at least like two independent, like sort of the line I keep repeating is like two independent layers of security so that like one could fail and you're still secure. But yeah, like I do like that rather than just secure default. And again, like I think if you look at how people use secure defaults, they did mean all of this, but language matters, words matter. And like I think, as these ideas spread and get memeified, yeah, secure defaults implies to people just one thing, whereas I think what we really want is paved roads and guardrails, which has like multiple aspects to it. So.
Yeah, I really like that description of it, and I've been talking about secure defaults for a while and chatting with many people about it. And I think like the way you described it and the words you used, I think helped me get like a better like specific mental modeling of it, or like a better way to describe it, maybe sort of like because I think mostly before I was using them kind of interchangeably or just saying like secure defaults, but I guess like the Eskimos who have like 10 words for snow, and you having like I think the like I think like the road metaphor you gave, I feel like resonates a lot with me, where you have like paved road, okay, cool, here's like where we want people to mostly use using secure frameworks or things like that. Then there's like one or more, say, rumble strips or something on the side of the road where there are sort of like orthogonal security control mechanisms. I think you said in this case, like DOM purify, SEMGREP, or other things. And then you have like this hard sort of secure guardrail, which I guess the word itself like sounds a little bit firmer or more like it's going to maybe hurt a little bit when you hit it, or it's like less of a warning and more of like a firm thing with content security policy for XSS in specific. So yeah, do you have another word for, I feel like, so we have like paved road is like the road, and then secure guardrail is sort of like this like very firm thing at the outside. Do you have like terms for like those middle security controls other than rumble strips, or do you just
I mean, the
usually say
shoulder,
that?
right? Like the shoulder is also between the paved road and the guardrail. So I use that also. And so the rumble strip could be a warning, and the shoulder could be another step, or it could be you could use them interchangeably. But like, yeah, you definitely don't want to go from paved road straight to guardrail, right? Like, again, like that would be really surprising and annoying that like, you made a slight, like, you're driving and you just like slightly turn and now suddenly your car has hit the guardrail. Like, and I think, similarly for developers, right? Like they want some warning, right? That this like, because CSP will maybe break things in unexpected ways. And like if they directly hit CSP without any warning, without being told like, hey, just FYI, this won't work, or CSP will block it, like that would be surprising. So I do think like you want to have that in there. So yeah.
Yeah, and I just realized for people who are watching this later who may be unfamiliar, CSP is a content security policy, a browser header that's sort of a defense in depth for cross-site scripting. And would you say like info leakage or perhaps other things as well?
I wouldn't say info leakage. I do think it is a good defense in depth for info leakage, as just like, but I don't think that should be the primary mechanism for preventing info leakage. It's pretty, sort of, that's not its intent. Its intent is controlling what content is loaded and cross-site scripting prevention. But yeah, I mean, I do think it can be the guardrail for controlling info leakage. But I do think you still need to enforce the controls on HTML and prevent untrusted HTML. There's just like Michael Zaleski has a bunch of great blog posts on this. But yeah, like I do think it can be a useful guardrail for that. Yeah.
Yeah, and you had a talk recently. Was it a hipster guide to cores or CSP? I forget.
A hipster history, of course. Yeah. That was my, yeah, I gave a talk at Strange Loop last year. Yeah, cores is probably one of the most frustrating things I've seen developers struggle with. And I think, I don't know, the weird security brain that I have, I was just like, yeah, this makes total sense. And then every developer would be like, what are you talking about? Like, this makes no sense. And I realized I kind of, it made sense to me because I knew the history behind why each of the steps. And I felt like, okay, explaining that will hopefully explain to people why cores is the way it is. And yeah, it's been, I just generally like enjoy technology history. And so it was fun to give that talk. Thankfully got accepted to Strange Loop, which is a fantastic conference if people haven't been. And yeah, it's great. Yeah.
Yeah, I really liked that talk. It's very like fun and playful, and I think like the history of how things came to be, yeah, to me made like I was already familiar with a lot of it, but I felt like that made the framing made it more clear, and you got into I think some more like esoteric headers or flags that I was like not as familiar with that I thought was cool.
Yeah, it was fun. It's keeps getting more and more complicated every year, the cross-origin story on browsers. And yeah, but again, like I think it's sort of seeing it as an incremental step as we try to fix problems sort of does make more sense, right? Like Spectre and Meltdown forced us to have sort of new headers, new controls. And again, right, like I hope, again, being an optimist, like, yeah, Spectre is scary, but I do think like 8 years from now, 5 years from now, or even faster, we'll have like, the ability to write websites that are sort of secure against Spectre Meltdown. I think at least. Let's see.
Yeah, I think so. I'm optimistic.
Yeah, exactly.
okay, so we talked a little bit about high level for what we mean by paved road, shoulder, guardrails, security faults. So let's like dive into that in a little bit more detail. I think there were a couple of ideas we discussed about useful concepts. Like, so let's say a company is like, cool, this sounds great. Oh, I guess we maybe because we talk about it so much, we maybe skipped some things. So I guess like some context about this like problem space is I think historically actually this is how I sometimes describe it to people, so feel free to disagree with me. I think like in the early days of security, there was a lot of focus on like how do we find all the bad things. So you have like fuzzers, dynamic analysis tools, static analysis tools, like all these ways to basically find the bad. Like, can we find cross-site scripting? Can we find SQL injection? All these things. But the thing is, just from like a provable computer science point of view, you can't do this perfectly right. You're either going to miss some things or you're going to find things that are not real, like false positives. So instead, like Google, Facebook, and many others, were basically like, hey, what if we instead built these like libraries or tools or processes that people could use that did all the hard things for you, whether that's parsing XML, an object relational mapper, or I'm talking the database. Like, what if we just made it easy to do the secure thing? And like, there's escape hatches for when you need them, but most of the time you don't need them, and you can just very easily do something securely, even though like output encoding, for example, in a web application, like understanding the difference in like whether you're in HTML context or a JavaScript context or like HTML attribute, there's like a lot of nuance there that as a developer is like it's hard to get right. So right, like it would be nice to like have them like not need to care about that. So anyway, so security industry was like, let's find all the bad. And then we were like, oh, what if we just made these like safe things for people that they could just use those. Like, wouldn't that be so nice? So the benefit of this is like rather than finding the bad, you just have to find the not good, which is a computationally very much easier to do and to be much more precise with. And ideally, this can help eliminate like classes of vulnerabilities rather than playing sort of bug whack-a-mole. I don't know.
I think
I feel
that
like
makes
we just
sense.
sort of. Oh, sorry. Keep going.
Good, good, good.
Oh, I was just gonna say, like, I felt like we were like diving right into it, and then I was like, oh, I guess we should maybe discuss what secure defaults are to just be clear we're on the same page and like why you
Yeah, I
care.
mean, I think, yeah, changing metaphors is always dangerous, but metaphors are useful. So I think the story I give, especially, I find that explaining security concepts with stories for people, maybe not with all the history we have, is useful. And so the story I give is I kind of compare it to like fire safety, where you don't like, I mean, and for folks who are interested, there's a great talk on the history of fire escapes. I forget the author's name, but by an SRE leader, and she has given a great talk on history of fire escapes that I strongly recommend checking out. Maybe we could link to it. But yeah, like imagine like. Looking for fire escapes is looking for attacks or looking for breaches or looking for exploits or vulnerabilities is sort of like if your fire inspector was only looking for fires, and it would be not great. And maybe it made sense when you were in complete firefighting mode, right? But like now we are like, okay, we are building new stuff. We want to prevent bad things from day one. You don't want them to wait till they see a fire, right? Like you want them to sort of say, well, this is not good. You're like blocking the fire exit, or the reverse pressure on the fire escape doesn't exist, or things like that. And so looking for deviations from good, deviations mean that like this is not best practice. This is, and then at that point where you see this deviation, an answer isn't like, oh, well, we don't do this because this other person is doing this. It's like, no, it has to be locally reasoned about why it is safe. And so similarly with AppSec, I think of that like, okay, there is an escape hatch. Maybe you have an option of not using the safe ORM, and you can use the unsafe escape hatch. But then, you don't want to be with like, well, we did this very complicated analysis and we looked at like these three other callers of the function to make sure it is safe. Because like tomorrow someone else could add another function call or something else could change, right? Like those dependencies are hard to reason about. You want to have the like, okay, you're using the escape hatch. I want to know just by that local, like the three lines next to it, that this is safe, right? Like I want to be able to reason at that level why this is safe. And that might involve like adding an assertion that like, oh, if I'm being called in the prod context, just error out, even though I'm not supposed to be called in prod context, just in any case, add a secondary check here, right? Like things like that are powerful. So like that's how I think about it. It's just that like it's secure defaults, escape hatches, and then you want to be able to locally reason about the safety of those escape hatches. It's not enough to just say, well, we have checked this, right? Because software changes, software evolves, teams are continuously writing new stuff. You don't want to be in a world where like reasoning about it requires, solving NP complete problems or something. So, yeah.
Yeah, I just want to like reemphasize that point because I like it a lot where yeah, if you see something that like within this function it looks dangerous, like ideally you don't want to have to like be able to load the entire program that could be like millions of lines of code into your brain to like be able to prove to yourself that like it's safe, right? Because like that's going to change. Code's always changing. Could be called by three things today, could be called by 10 things tomorrow. Some of those aren't going to have the safety properties that you wanted. So yeah, this is almost like just a code quality or hygiene thing. But I think ideally being able to reason about the security properties of a piece of code, like just locally, like within like one file or one function, or at most maybe like two files, I feel like to be honest, that's it's not always easy to get there, but I feel like that's like a utopian dream place that we can like hope for sometimes.
And I like to say, like, if it is the case that it is easy to reason that this extra line of code is unnecessary, the compiler can do it for you, right? Like they are optimizing performance, they will do it for you. But in most cases, it's not, because it can be called. And that's exactly why you want to have that check, right? Like the, you're not going to be able to keep more context in your head than the compiler or JavaScript JIT engine, right? Like, so I think that's the other thing. So it's like, no, let's keep it safe. Like, let's design resilient, safe by default systems. And I think that's really important. And it's, you want to, like, there's enough complexity, let's not add to it. Yeah,
totally. Okay, so we took a quick step back to be like, okay, why do we care about secure defaults? And like, what is the big picture? And some like a nice fire escape metaphor. But okay, so let's say someone listening is like, okay, cool, I'm on a security team, or I run one, and I want to do this at my company. I'm curious, what are some ways of thinking about this, or like ways of doing it that you found effective personally in what you've done either at Dropbox or Figma? I think you called out a couple of things when we were chatting about this before, like ratcheting or prioritizing risk and things like that. So yeah, wherever you'd like to start, how do you feel like is a good way to make defaults or paved roads like actionable?
Yeah, I think, yeah, again, like those are the two steps in my head. It's like prioritizing risk. I think one of the, an easy trap to fall into as a security team or a security engineer is, you know, everything is sort of, you know, broken. We need to fix everything and then try to fix everything. And you sort of like thrash trying to do everything and it doesn't work. I think picking one thing at a time and accepting risk on things that you're not prioritizing is far more likely to succeed. And then once you have prioritized something, I think you wanna, you know, the way to move to a more safe world, secure by default or whatever you wanna call it, I think involves what I call ratcheting, which is
Deb, before you get into ratcheting, you talked about like prioritizing things. Like, I'm curious, like more like tactically how. So let's say we parachuted you into a new company, you knew nothing about it, like, you know, tomorrow, like. How would you know either like globally amongst different areas of security, or if you want to choose like just AppSec or ProdSec, feel free to do that. But yeah, I'm curious, like, yeah, how would you prioritize then? Or I guess what information would you gather in what order ish to like make that decision? So like, let's say you know nothing, new company.
Yeah. Yeah. I think like first I sort of like to think about, you know, there's this concept called the base rate fallacy where I, you know, the thing that gets you is the thing that like gets everyone, right? Like statistically, like I give the examples of hiking. I love hiking. I've gone to some interesting hikes. And I always like to remind people like the scariest part of the hike, the statistically, is the drive to it, because car accidents far and away kill far more people than anything else. And so I think it's easy to sort of, you know, forget that, like, you know, if you're going hiking, it's still the most important safety check is like wearing the seatbelt on the car, because, you know, and so similarly, I think people sort of can sometimes over fixate on risks that are specific to their organization. But statistically, the things that are going to get them hacked is what's getting everyone else hacked. So I tend to sort of first think about like, okay, what are the most common things that are getting people hacked? And today I would probably put like, you know, so the ransomware, you know, if you look like releases from the US CERT or CISA and stuff like that, they'll talk about how ransomware gets into companies. And I think it's usually social engineering, credit stuffing, or malware downloads. And so I would say those are probably the biggest risks that everyone should focus on first. And then I think focusing on sort of business specific risks makes sense, but definitely those are things. And you know, it's not all or nothing. You probably want to invest based on your resources on multiple things, but you do want to have you know, resources focused on like mitigating the more egregious common risks, even though, you know, there is something unique about your program, your product that is risky. It's just not likely to be hit first. So base rate of like these classic like background radiation attacks is really high. So focusing on that first is my recommendation. And under that theme, I sort of think about, it's important for security leaders to have threat intel. And by threat intel, I mean, like there's two types of threat intel. There's micro threat intel, which is sort of what specific IOCs and TTPs people are using, which is important. But I think far and away for most people, what they need is what I call macro threat intel, which is more broadly what is happening, what is causing breaches, what are the tactics used by attackers in the most common attacks and breaches. That's what I think people should look at. And I think one of them, again, like in the theme of things getting better, I think it's been really sort of great now that, you know, agencies like CISA, the Cyber Safety Review Board, the reports they come out, like if people haven't read the Lapsus, incident review from like the CSRB, I strongly recommend reading it. It's fantastic. And I think that those are the sort of things sort of like we can learn from, and we can say, okay, these are the things to prioritize. And so I'd say that macro threat intel and like understanding the base rate of what things are being attacked, that's really the first thing to prioritize. And then obviously based on your business and what is risky for your business is probably the other thing to think about, right? Like if you are a Bitcoin company, the things that are likely to be attacking you are very different from if you're a social media company, where maybe spam and abuse is a far bigger risk. And so I think that's where then the business context also comes in, and learning from other peers who are also in a similar business also matters. But yeah, that's kind of the two ways I think about how to prioritize risk. And then I think once you know how to prioritize. The other thing I'd say about prioritizing risk and thinking about what to work on is, you have to pick a decision, move on. Like excessive time just planning the ideal path is also expensive, right? Like one of my favorite books is Algorithms to Live By, which is this book on like what can we learn from CS algorithms for our day-to-day life. And they talk about, many things, but like one of the examples is like query optimization in databases, right? Like databases get a query, they could spend a bunch of time trying to figure out what's the best way to run this query. But turns out what databases actually do is sort of set a time limit and say, I'm going to try my best in those few, within that time limit to try to optimize what I'm going to do, and then just go with it. Because actually, more time spent optimizing the query is actually a waste more often than not. And then separately, the databases are also, while the query is executing, monitor it and see, okay, this is actually causing waivers or wasting too much time, and then slightly optimize it, especially for the long-lived queries. And so I think that sort of iterative process where like, set a time bound, pick what you want to prioritize, and then just start fixing, and then have regular check-ins where you're sort of changing your priorities, updating things, updating your risk map. I think that's sort of the strategy I approach things with, and I think that seems to work, at least knock on wood. So yeah, I think that's what I would recommend for most security leaders. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that makes sense because you obviously it's good to not just willy-nilly like do the first thing that comes on your plate, but it similarly is not useful to take like 3 years to decide what your security program is going to invest in. At some point it's like just like there's probably a couple of things that are more obviously on fire than others. Like you might as well start on one of them. Maybe it's not the most pressing of the five, but like it's at least like close. So
And
yeah,
then you
to
can move on to the most pressing thing after, right? Like it's fine. Yeah. So yeah.
yeah, totally. I'm curious, like so you talked about like social engineering, phishing, running malware, things like that. I'm curious if you were to sort of like zoom in on AppSec or ProdSec, I'm curious like how you would prioritize within that, just because that's a space that I'm sort of like selfishly interested in.
Yeah, I do think like in AppSec, again, like the most common things that are getting companies hacked, SQL injection, SSRF, and cross-site scripting, CSRF are probably the ones that I would sort of target first. I think timing flaws or like, just to take an extreme, it's like quantum cryptography resistance for our cryptography is probably not the thing you want to start with. And so, and I think people resonate with the quantum cryptography bit, but just generally, I think just that theory applies to everything, right? Like we have to prioritize the most common thing. And so let's start with SSRF. And then I think depending on your business, again, right, like maybe if you have a vector for people to send emails from your application, like, spam is by far the most common thing that happens on the internet. So I think if you have that vector, like worrying about spam and abuse is probably pretty high up there. And then I think the longer tail of AppSec specific risks, authorization flaws and stuff, which are again really important, but like far more likely to be breached by someone just opportunistically looking for an SSRF and stealing AWS creds than something else like that. But like, yeah, credential management also, like, which I don't know whether it comes under AppSec or InfraSec, but like, yeah, if you're sending AWS credentials somewhere or checking them into source code or onto public Git repos and stuff, that is definitely getting exploited very quickly. if it's on the internet somewhere, your AWS credit will definitely get exploited very quickly. So I think things like that.
Yeah, that makes sense. Cool. Well, yeah, thanks for sharing. Quickly before we chat about ratcheting, so with regards to like prioritizing risk, you mentioned like, you know, be aware of the base rate fallacy. The things that are going to hack you are the things that are going to hack every company. So looking at, you know, what is CISA saying, how are like ransomware groups typically getting in, like social engineering, phishing, like malware, stuff like that. Be aware of like some threat intel type things, like what's just sort of like happening, maybe being aware of things in the media. You know, don't spend forever choosing something to target, just choose something like that's good enough and then execute on it. And then for like AppSec, like what are the vulnerability classes most likely to have people be hacked? Just sort of the bread and butter, SQL injection, cross-site scripting, SSRF for like stealing AWS creds, creds posted to like, you know, GitHub or other places. Yeah. That all makes sense. I liked everything you said, but one of the things I especially liked is the, like everyone, including me, likes to think you're sort of like the special unicorn, and it's like, yeah, totally, someone's gonna do this like crazy esoteric business logic hack, when it's like, or they're just gonna fish one of your customer service people, and then they're gonna get in, and they have access to an admin panel, and like, it's always the same story. So I don't know.
Yeah. Lapses is what gets it, not the, like, you know, people breaking quantum crypto. So yeah,
Okay. So yeah, let's talk about ratcheting, which I think is a super cool idea that I want to hear more about.
Yeah, for sure. So the, you know, ratchets in real life, like the nice thing about ratchets is once you install them, they can only go in one direction. You know, you can only tighten them. And so I think that's the general idea of ratcheting, which is if you want to make something more secure, you know, install a security control, make sure like CSP is enforced or secure frameworks are used. I think it is very easy to get sort of like worried or thrashed around with like the scope and the size of the problem. And I sort of keep encouraging teams to focus on what this ratcheting strategy, which is just install it somewhere, right? Like install your secure control somewhere, or even if you don't install it, just start with no new code will ship without the secure control, or pick one area of the code that says this code now is secure. It has CSP enabled. You know, again, like talking about, you know, 10 years ago, like when at my first job, it was sort of a win to deploy a CSP that just had HTTPS:, because just enforcing TLS everywhere was seen as a win, right? Like the, in those days. And so I think getting to, you know, just pick one thing and then start making the control stronger. So expanding it to more and more places that like, okay, this one, you know, route or this one file has all the secure controls, then the second file, then the third file, then the fourth file, and so on is great, because then you can track progress. And but you need to have the control that things cannot slide back, right? And so that's where engineering it in such a way that the control cannot slide back is important. And then it's really nice, I personally find, at least when I'm working on projects for my morale, to be able to see, you know, progress, build momentum. And I just find typically in engineering projects, momentum begets momentum. Like sort of once you build momentum, your speed actually gets faster and faster, and you make more progress. And so yeah, just like one file, three files, 10 files, 15, and then soon everything has the secure control. And then the other aspect of ratcheting is like, maybe you start with something simple where it's like a CSP policy that just enforces everything is HTTPS. And then you say, okay, it enforces that, you know, unsafe inline is allowed, but like only the places to load JavaScript files from is this list of like safe listed URIs. And then you work on like removing unsafe inline, and then you work on removing unsafe eval. It's fine. Not everybody wrote their CSP policy, you know, from zero to, you know, everything all in one go. It takes time. But just make sure you have controls that ensure that things are not sliding back, and then, you know, slowly make progress, and that's how like the biggest changes are made. So I sort of have approached many of the security control changes we have made with that mindset, and I think, you know, talking about how I learned AppSec and moved to like, you know, broader areas, I feel like I have a long Twitter thread about how we rolled out WebAuthn at Figma.
Mm-hmm.
And I think similarly there, I think we approached it with this mindset of ratcheting, which is like, let's get WebAuthn working for some people, then a few more people. Let's start with like getting it working for a few applications, enforcing it as a requirement for sensitive applications, then enforcing it for a few more applications. And then pretty soon we were able to say, okay, now we know it works. We know it works for everyone. And let's just ramp it up to 100%. And so again, like I think trying to sort of go from zero to 100% on day one, I mean, no amount of planning will prepare you for all the, and I talk about this in the Twitter thread, but like there's just always something one unknown mm-hmm. that's coming up. And then I personally, again, like maybe this is my mindset, but I personally don't find the planning as exciting. It's often demoralizing, but like starting with mm-hmm. one step and then, you know, slowly, slowly increasing, building momentum, I find that velocity and momentum actually drives much more joy in day-to-day work, which is just always a great thing. So, yeah.
Yeah, I really liked that Twitter thread. I think you actually did two of them, maybe about specifically WebAuthn. Yeah, I linked to both of them in TLDR sec. But yeah, we can link to them in the notes as well. But yeah, I loved it because it was so like actionable and like tactical, and it was like, yeah, like we tried these things, but then there's like all these random edge cases that you only find out later. And I thought that was really nice.
And things we failed at, right? Like it's sort of like, oh, I think I gave an example of like a YubiKey where, you know, someone was confused by it. And then when she explained what was the confusion, I was like, yeah, makes total sense. Like you're absolutely right. And I think, again, like I like publicly talking about failures because I think, you know, at least when I was joining the industry, it felt like, yeah, everyone had like figured out these things that were perfect. And it's just really like all of us are continuously learning and iterating. And so I like sharing like mistakes and lessons learned. So,
yeah, I like that a lot, too. To give another example of a concrete like ratcheting thing. So you gave a couple of examples, like another one, looking at it more from like a code point of view, or just like a specific, very concrete code example. Like generally, when you want to start enforcing any new property that you haven't had in the past, there's going to be like so many examples that like currently like is not the case in the code that, you know, you're supporting like, you know, hundreds of thousands or millions or more lines of code. You're like, I want to start doing things this way. Like there's probably, you know, hundreds of ways or hundreds of pieces of code that like don't do that now. So you don't want to like demoralize yourself or developers to use your words, go from like zero to 100 day one. You want to be like, okay, like basically it's like we have this huge backlog of things that are like known, not good, but like we're going to be fine with those for now. But let's make it so that things like you're not introducing new ones like so specifically, let's say we're like, okay, you know, we care about SQL injection, so we want every piece of code to either use an ORM or at least like some parameterized SQL query that we've sort of like blessed is like, this is an okay way to do it. So it's like, cool, we've got 1,000 unparameterized SQL queries now, but any new code that is coming in a PR, like we're going to make sure that, you know, that's parameterized or using an ORM. So like nothing. So we have 1,000 bad cases. It's never going to go above 1,000 because we basically, you know, set maybe some scanning in CI so that like no new ones could get introduced. And then over time you can just be like, you know, do like make that go down, down, down. I don't know, maybe you have some like happy chart somewhere on the dashboard that like shows something going from red to green and everyone's like, yeah.
And as a manager, you know, buy your team something nice when the number goes to zero, right? Like that's another key trick that like, you know, I don't drink alcohol much, but like, yeah, there was definitely one project that was like this ratchet that was, you know, it took a lot longer than we had planned. It took a year instead of the original estimate of, I think it was 1.5 quarters. And yeah, that was at the end of that, yeah, I got whiskey, like I broke open a whiskey bottle with the team and we drank to the zero on the dashboard. That was great. So, yeah.
Nice. Yeah. That makes sense. So kind of like along those lines about sort of just like big picture mindset things, you had a blog post a bit ago that I really liked called sort of like modern static analysis. And there were a bunch of really insightful parts of it that I want to like drill into. But yeah, I wonder like, could you maybe give people a little bit of a like what was sort of your core thesis and like how you view things as having changed or changing in that. We'll dig into it, but yeah.
Yeah, I think like for me, maybe it's some of it is just my background and why I got into security. I think I talked about how like I got into security because I think it's just the most interesting place to write software. There's an active attacker, things are continuously evolving. James Kettle is writing new talks. Like, you know, you're sort of like continuously working. It requires a lot of creativity. And it often felt like a lot of the tools that sort of people want us to use aren't really encouraging my creativity. And I think the So some of the impetus for it was, and there were tools I liked, right? Like there were tools like SEMGREP that I liked, but I couldn't sort of really put my finger on why, you know, me and a lot of other like modern AppSec teams love SEMGREP a lot more. And this is from, like, you know, we talked about the papers, like, and you did your research in static analysis. I wrote a few papers on dynamic analysis. Like we're people who've done like, you know, PhD research in analysis and we're using SEMGREP, right? And it's like, why is that? And I think that's where, you know, being at Figma, there was a coworker, Molly Milky, who she had written this great thesis on what makes digital tools really great for creatives and what really breeds creativity in digital tools. And she had this framework of, you know, the digital tools that really allow us to be creative is are tools that are sort of interoperable, moldable, efficient, and community driven. So interoperable means that like you can move them around, use them in different places. You don't have to be stuck in one place. Moldable means I can customize them, and efficient means they're quick because sort of you want that feedback cycle as you are being creative with the tools. And then there's a community. I think that really resonated with me, that the tools that I really enjoy are the ones that are in that category. And I think like that sort of has been a framework that I found very useful. Like the security tools I really enjoy are the ones that I can sort of, they're quick. I can mold them to sort of the particular needs we have. They aren't like forcing me to mold myself to them, but they mold into, you know, what we need. And they can like, I can use them in many places, not just like, here's the only way to use us and nothing else. And then there's a community around it that like I can join, you know, like, I just learned so much from the security community. And so why shouldn't my tools also be part of that? And so I think that's what I've found. And yeah, like, thanks for sharing it on TLDRSec, but like it was like, yeah, the blog post was more, I need to write this down because it's like bouncing around in my head like endlessly. So, but yeah, like it really sort of clarified to me personally why I enjoy tools like SEMGREP. I just find them so effective. Yeah.
Yeah. I liked that the post a lot because, yeah, I feel like it helped solidify for me in my brain as well, like how I thought about certain things where it's, like there are some, tools or some ways to approach building things where you're like, okay, cool, we're going to build sort of like this black box that like does, like that solves this one problem. But, you know, it can never really be applied to like other adjacent problems. I think one reason why, like Burp Suite, for example, is so popular is that like, yes, it has like a really great, like automated web app scanning functionality. It can like send a bunch of payloads. It can do it a bunch of different ways. It can crawl apps. Like it can do everything a Dask scanner does. And like they do have like commercial offerings for that. But also if you're a tester who either wants to manually or in like a semi-automated way, like totally customize it to that specific application because like maybe the way it does authorization or authentication is different. Like you can do that. So it's not like, like an already built solution. It's like, how do we provide you capabilities or like fundamental building blocks or be like another tool in your tool belt for things that you can do in like one area? And I think it seems like you're about to say something, so I'll let you go.
Say, and community, right? Like the Burp Suite team is just really encourages community, people sharing plugins and. And I think that has also been really positive, right? Like you don't feel lost and like you need to talk to a salesperson. There are forums and there are other people in the hacker community who are excited to share and learn from each other. And that also helps a lot. So I do think community also is like, Burp Suite is a great example of where community, SEMGREP is also another, like this, the community really helps, I personally find. So yeah, in addition to that, I was going to say community also has been really powerful for Burp. Yeah.
Yeah, Burp definitely has a bunch of extensions. So yeah, when I was a security consultant at NCC Group, yeah, there was a bunch of extensions that were super helpful. And about SEMGREP, yeah, we like, yes, it can be applied to security, but we view it as more, or at least the vision is more of like, how do we build like the most capable search tool, whether that's like searching a programming language, a traditional programming language, whether that's searching infrastructure as code like Terraform or Pulumi, whether that's looking at JSON or YAML or even like Markdown or text or HTML, like basically whatever it is, we want to take what's in your head and like make it easy to like search for that. So there's obviously security applications, but like other stuff too. So,
Absolutely. I mean, we use it at Figma, right? Like an engineer's sort of self-select into saying, well, I want to do this check. And the number of times in Slack is like, oh, maybe we can do it with SimGrep, right? Like developers love using SimGrep. I do think like SimGrep is the most powerful tool for that, increasingly for developers. The bigger change, I think, is sort of what we talked about. Like security has gotten used to the idea of like security firewalls, secure guardrails, paved roads, and like encouraging people. And I think that is becoming more and more common in other aspects, but like that applies to so many things, right? Like how you write accessible software, how you write high performance software. You know, it's like, hey, this function is super slow, this function is faster, you know, this function is deprecated. You know, all of this applies. These lessons apply everywhere, and I think I'm excited for more engineers to use tools like SimGrep.
Yeah, you actually have a couple of like interesting use cases for SimGrep that I don't know if you like mind mentioning that that I thought would be kind of interesting because I think when people think about SAST or like security focused static analysis, they're like, okay, I'm looking for SQL injection or cross-site scripting, or it's very much like there's a set of bad things I'm looking for, and then I'm gonna like block the build or like comment on the pull request or something like that. But I feel like there's many other like classes of things that you could do or like different like use cases that I think you know you and your team do. So yeah, I was curious if you mind sharing some of those.
I mean, there are so many, but I think one is sort of, I call it like intelligence on the change, right? Like there's a lot of code being written. And I think that one framing is also really important about modern software is that like modern software is changing all the time. You cannot treat it as a point in time, I've checked and done. And so how do we sort of stay aware and stay up to date with what's happening? And so use SimGrep to see what are the new routes being shipped. And then that feeds into one, our review. So it doesn't have to be like a blocking review. It's just once a week we audit it. These are the new routes introduced in the application. And are they secure? Are they doing the authorization check correctly? But also I, as a leader, look at it as, you know, how many of these routes are surprises, right? Like how many of these routes are features we didn't know about and we should have partnered with engineers before on this, right? Because that's sort of an indication that our program and partnership program isn't being as effective as we want. And so I think that's another angle of just like how are we performing as a team in terms of partnering with the rest of the organization. So I think like new route, new sort of, and I would extend the route to just like new attack surface analysis, right? So it isn't about whether it's secure, whether it's deviation from good or bad, like stuff like that. It's more like this is new attack surface introduced to the application. And that could be a new application load balancer because, you know, our infrastructure is also code. It's like a new ALB that's listening on the internet, or it could be a new route in our application logic, or it could be a new user in the database, because it's also something we can detect with in an IaC world. And so I think understanding like how the application and the product is evolving using SimGrep has been really powerful. I think, I guess, yeah, I mean, we've also used it for performance, right? Like some security functions can actually be slower. And so telling people like, hey, there is an alternative function that is both more secure and faster. I don't know if I can share the Figma specific examples, but you can guess, right? Like some hash functions are actually more secure and faster nowadays. And but like, you know, we have taught people old hash functions for a long time. And so you know, like things like that, just like encouraging better practices that are also more secure and faster. I think, yeah, so I think it's been really effective. Like I do agree with you, sort of it would be almost a shame to only look at, you know, your tool for looking at attacks. And that's what I love about, you know, multiple tools like SimGrep, right? That like if it was a black box that could only detect bugs, it would be really sort of unfortunate. And I think the you know, the advantage of SimGrep is that it's multiple. Similarly with Burp Suite, like if you could, you know, a typical task would look for bugs. But with Burp Suite, you can automate and say, no, I just want to know if anytime a content security policy is missing, or I just want to know anytime the XVM options is missing, or like this, you know, our internal pages don't require auth, or this page is accessible without authentication and things like that. That like that can just be a safety check, you know, seatbelts, instead of sort of, you know, always looking for a bug, right? Like it can be a secondary safety check. So I think again, because these tools are moldable and I can sort of adapt them, it's really powerful.
Yeah, I really love your emphasis on like visibility. I feel like that's such a powerful, useful thing for security teams. Whether that's people who are like doing more from like a detection and response point of view, or I guess I feel like there's certain areas of security that have been thinking about sort of like visibility and observability for a while. But I feel like there are some people talking about that within like AppSec and ProdSec, but I feel like I don't hear that as much. But I'm starting to hear more about it. So I really like when people talk about that because it's like, yes, it would be nice to know like where's all the XSS and SQL injection, but what's also super useful is like, hey, did you know that we launched like 10 new routes this week? Like, that's interesting. Like, and also like I guess it also depends on like what is like the rate of expansion. Like maybe maybe your company has like 10 new routes every week, so you're like, cool. But then maybe 1 week it's like 50, so you're like, why is there so
What
much more
happened?
than normal? Like what happened? And I hadn't actually thought of this before, but I love what you said about using it as a metric for like, are we partnering effectively with teams? Like, ideally you have someone in the room or reviewing scope docs to be like, cool, here's new major features that are being launched, so we expect to see these new things. But if you see via sort of like visibility, whether that's like whatever tools you're using, like you're like, oh cool, like we had no idea these things were happening. Oh, maybe like the developers self-organized into some team that we didn't know existed, so we should probably proactively reach out and like let them know we exist and like partner with them. So yeah, I thought that was a super cool use case that I hadn't thought of before, but I like it.
Yeah, it's been, I mean, hopefully that doesn't come up too often, but yeah, like it is a useful tool. And I think, yeah, like I think sort of, again, continuously building, all of these are sort of, again, going back to learning, right? Like we want to be a learning organization that's continuously adapting and learning, and you want those signals, right? Like you don't want to kid yourself that, okay, I'm running my, black box scanner that told me there is no XSS, and so it's good. And it's like, well, it doesn't even know about these like 500 new routes that are in this completely new different area, like stuff like that. So yeah, like you want your tools where you can sort of move them around to the right places that you need.
Yeah, totally. Like a final example that I think you mentioned to me that I thought was super cool is kind of like a just-in-time developer education type use case where let's say your company has some like company-specific APIs or like how you do authentication or authorization tends to be done in a certain way, and someone maybe submits some new code that maybe uses a sensitive API like. It might not even be wrong, like it might not be different than how you want it to be done, but you might want to be like, hey, like just like almost like an informational comment to be like, hey, by the way, if you're using this API, here's like some relevant context, and maybe here's a link to our internal docs on like how to use this, which I thought was like such a cool idea. It's like we're not saying that you're wrong, we're just like programmatically being like, here's some relevant docs in like a very helpful non-blocking way. So I don't know if there's more you wanted to say about that, but I thought it was such a cool idea.
Yeah, I mean, again, like, yeah, we're able to use it as education because of that whole system where we can quickly, integrate it with the pull requests and like the development process, and then remind people that, okay, you're using this hash function, our recommended hash function is this one. Here's why. I've generally found, in general, I found developers being hungry for security content and security education, which again, like maybe I'm an optimist, but every time a Hacker News post comes up about like quantum crypto or some new hack, you have just like people sharing it and super excited about it. And I think like that's an indication that like developers typically are excited to learn. I think security teams that actually, I mean, the documentation, the guidelines have to be good. They have to stand to scrutiny, not just be like arbitrary rules, but like I generally find engineers excited to learn and showing them like here's the issue with hash, and here's why HMACs are more secure, or here's why storing tokens hashed is actually safer than storing tokens directly in a database. There's just so many opportunities where it's like, okay, this is just set this flag, and that's why it is more secure. Is sort of being very effective. So with SemGrep, for example, there are, Python lets you call, a command like either as a string or as an array, and SemGrep lets us detect that and say like, okay, if the first argument is a string, even though it is safe, they're probably using it in context that is safe. Just like, hey, just FYI, arrays are safer for this reason. And I'm not saying all developers just like go with the safer reason, safer system, but there are definitely developers who just like on principle are just like, yeah, that's the safer thing to do, so I'm gonna do that. And that's great, right? Like we should sort of encourage that. Not everything has to be, if it's security review, security block or nothing, that's not a great way to build a relationship. I think sort of this middle ground of like, hey, I'm not blocking you, it's an acceptable risk, but this is nicer. I think that's usually one, it's good for developer education, but also I think longer term, it is effective for security trust, because if the only time the security team talks to developers is this is bad and you need to stop, then like they'll think, security complains all the time. But if they have a history of like, okay, six times in the past, security team has said, this is not great, but we're accepting it, they tend to sort of find security more trustworthy, and that leads to better relationships. Yeah.
Yeah, agreed. I think like you can block, but generally should be few and far between. And yeah, totally agree about building trust. And I think oftentimes developers and just everyone wants to do the right thing. It's just like, have you made it obvious to them what the right thing is, and is it easy for them to do? And if you're providing them like a little blurb that's like, hey, just copy this code in instead, like it takes them no time, and they're like, I want to do the right thing. I'm a good citizen.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Developers want to write great systems, right? Like people want to have pride in the work they have done in their craft. And so, yeah, just helping them there is I think very effective.
Yeah, totally. I've asked you about many things, and I really appreciate all the insights you've shared. Yeah, is there any like final anything you wanted to mention, or any like parting words or advice, or something that maybe you're excited about? I don't know. Anything you'd like to
I
say
think
before we stop?
parting words would just be what I said earlier. I truly mean it, that like I'm continuously learning, so probably some things in here that I'm gonna learn later that I was wrong. So I would love people telling me, message me. Don't feel like, oh my God, he said this, I can't believe it. Just like message me, let's chat. I'm always learning, and yeah, like security is a great field, and we need more and more people to join us. So yeah, please please reach out if I can help. But yeah, that's all.
Yeah, where can people find you? And is Figma currently hiring?
I should say, yeah, Figma is hiring. You can check us out, figma.com/jobs. Of course, we also have a presentation in Figma at figma.fun/secenge that talks about how all the roles and what we're hiring for, how the teams are structured. And then I'm at devd.me, where you can find links to my Twitter and LinkedIn and stuff. But yeah, and we can probably link to it from the show notes. So yeah.
Totally. Well, yeah, I wanted to give you like a shout out from
Yeah.
me for I feel like I've learned a ton from you over the years. We were on a bunch of panels together, and I feel like you've had a huge role in forming sort of how I think about modern security and what I think is important to focus on. So I appreciate you sharing cool stuff with me over a number of years and being a good friend.
Yeah, same. Thank you so much. And yeah, congrats on TLDRSec. It's so great to see it. And yeah, I think it was with you that I had the like famous, grep is great. Like, let's use grep. And I still hear from people about it. And I think, yeah, like now you're working on SEMgrep, which is amazing. And I love that tool. So yeah, thanks a lot.
For quick context, yeah, it was at AppSecCali. We were on a panel, and I think we were just talking about like static analysis in general, and you were just like, grep is so great.
Yeah, it is. But SEMgrep is better. So, yeah.
Yeah, but it just amused me so much to be like, yeah, PhD from Berkeley has built like symbolic execution and static analysis, very fancy tools, and you're like, grep, number one.
Yeah. But yeah, thanks a lot. Yeah, it's been fun. Thanks for inviting me to this panel, and thanks for having me here. It's a lot of fun, and yeah, as always, glad to learn from you every time we chat. It's always fun. Yeah, thank you for your help.
For sure. Yeah. Happy to, my friend. Well, yeah, thank you again so much for your time. And everyone who's watching this, feel free to say hi to Dev or me on Twitter. I don't know, like and subscribe to this
Thanks. Yeah.
channel or something like that. But yeah, have a great rest of your day wherever you are.